Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a discussion on how the press is already acting as the enabler of the next round of hostage taking, where Republicans threaten to turn the United States into a deadbeat nation in order to exercise their extreme ideology and satisfy their billionaire backers. Eric Bolet, a senior fellow at Media Matters and author of Lapdogs, How the Press Rolled Over for Bush, joins us to discuss how the next debt ceiling debacle is already being framed as he said, she said, and politics as usual. Then we'll assess today's speech by the besieged Syrian dictator Bashar al-Assad that was a mixture of defiance and delusion, devoid of any mention of a diplomatic possibility to end a war that is destroying Syria and has already claimed 60,000 lives. Henri Bakke, a former member of the State Department's policy planning staff, joins us to discuss the consequences of a collapse of the Assad regime and its regional impact, particularly on Iraq. He has an article at The American Interest, Spinoff, The Syrian Crisis and the Future of Iraq. Then finally, following last Friday's jobs report, we will look into the future of jobs as the American economy becomes more and more about profits without prosperity. William Lozonik, the director of the Center for Industrial Competitiveness, joins us to discuss if, how, and when full employment will return, and his article at the Huffington Post, Robots Don't Destroy Jobs, Rapacious Corporate Executives Do. Joining us now is Eric Bolet, who's a senior fellow at Media Matters for America and a former senior writer for Salon. His books include Lapdogs, How the Press Rolled Over for Bush, and Bloggers on the Bus, How the Internet Changed Politics and the Press. Welcome to Background Briefing, Eric Bolet.
Thanks for having me.
And some time back, Eric, the president in, I think it's about a week ago, on Meet the Press with David Gregory, he sort of said, I hope this time around the press don't treat the debt ceiling crisis as they did the last time, which is, you know, a plague on both their houses. What's your sense of, given that the president has laid down a marker saying he refuses to fall into the trap again and take this insanity seriously, do you think he can get away with that?
I don't think he will, because I don't think the press will adhere to his request. The Republican Party, and particularly the Republicans in the House, have lurched further and further, farther and farther to the right, and now conduct themselves in a way that's unrecognizable to anything that we've seen in modern American politics in terms of the absolute obstructionism, et cetera, and the way they, quote, negotiated with Obama on this. But you certainly would not know that from reading the press. The word radical is virtually never mentioned when talking about the current Republican mindset. The word filibuster has rarely been, you know, in context, rarely mentioned over the last 4 years in terms of trying to describe why nothing gets done in Congress. The press has adopted this sort of working platform that if Republicans oppose it, therefore it's news. And they're being sane, and they're acting in a way that is not unusual. And we, as journalists, we cannot make any sort of judgment calls. We just have to report that, you know, the Republicans are objecting to whatever Obama is suggesting, or, you know, when John Boehner can't even get his own Republican caucus to pass Plan B back in December, then that is just sort of portrayed as sort of a normal sort of bump along the road in these sort of high-stakes negotiations. They absolutely refuse to put in context how the Republicans, again, particularly in the House, are behaving, or put into context this sort of unworkable situation that Obama has given faces when he's trying to negotiate with people who don't act the way politicians or the party out of power has acted for decades, if not centuries, in Washington.
So, but when the press covers a real hostage crisis, they don't, you know, basically say, "Well, we need the point of view of the hostage negotiator as well as the hostage taker."
Right. And, you know, and I'm not suggesting this is, you know, akin to a hostage situation, but the Beltway press is forever concerned, nervous, intimidated by the right-wing claim of liberal media bias. So they go out of their way not to portray the conservative movement or Republicans as being out of the mainstream, acting in a radical manner, or in any way adopting unprecedented tactics, all of which they've been doing for the last 4 years and even for longer than that. Let's talk about, a recent example that wasn't related to the debt crisis, but showed how the press absolutely refuses to call Republicans out, which was their very pointed and aggressive attacks on Susan Rice to become, there was talk that she might be nominated for Secretary of State. Several Republicans noted that they would put a hold on her nomination. Republican Senator from Maine said she would oppose any Secretary of State nomination that Obama would give until he properly explained Benghazi. So this was portrayed in the press of, well, gee, Susan Rice is facing, you know, stiff opposition in the Senate, and Republicans are opposed to Susan Rice. What was completely missing is this has never been done before. There's never been a preemptive attack on a newly elected president's Secretary of State nominee. Newly elected presidents for centuries have been given the right to essentially appoint whoever they want to be Secretary of State. Up until Condoleezza Rice, I believe, got 12 no votes when she was nominated for Secretary of State. That was the most in modern American history. But Susan Rice faced this onslaught of Republican assault even before she was nominated, and the press just treated it, oh, this is normal. You know, these are how these cabinet nominees are always treated. It wasn't. No one had ever been faced the kind of attack she had, but the press absolutely refused to put it in context. When we're dealing with the debt crisis and negotiation, we see the same thing again and again. We've never really seen the party out of power act in the way they're acting, but the press is just pretending this is how it's always done. And I think a lot of it has to do with the fear of being, you know, labeled liberal media bias.
Again, I'm speaking with Eric Bollett, who's a senior fellow at Media Matters for America and a former senior writer for Salon. His books include Lapdogs, How the Press Rolled Over for Bush, and Bloggers on the Bus, How the Internet Changed Politics and the Press. Obviously, we have no consensus in this country about what's true anymore. People do what they call reality shopping. Conservatives get their information from Fox and liberals from MSNBC and Christians from Christian Broadcasting. But we do have a couple of decent newspapers, in particular the New York Times. NPR is supposed to be a fair and balanced in a real sense, but they're so afraid of the Republicans, particularly in the House, who control their purse strings, that they seem to go out of their way. There was a discussion recently amongst the NPR editorial staff about how the first hostage crisis was covered in this binary way that enslaves the American press convention, which is for in the universe of discourse, there are two equal and opposite black and white opinions, and you have to have thesis, synthesis, thesis, antithesis, synthesis. You have to have the pro argument, right, the con argument, and then this kind of meaningless mush. What is your sense of whether NPR is actually adopting a little more realism and are showing some courage in actually calling people out when they're talking absolute nonsense?
Well, that's a good question, and if you're talking specifically with the debt coverage, I probably haven't heard enough of the day-to-day coverage to say. It's encouraged that people are at least talking about it internally. I think, you know, if you're covering this on a daily basis, all the journalists know what we're talking about. I mean, they're all smart, college-educated. They've all been in D.C. They know how this stuff works. And so when they see Republicans acting the way they act, they understand, just like we do, this is crazy. We've never seen anything like this. The gulf then becomes, do you have the nerve to write that? Do you have the nerve to go on the air? Will your editor approve it? What will the backlash be if you simply acknowledge that the Republican Party is acting in a completely radical way? Two people who have documented the radical nature of the Republican Party in the last 4 years have been Thomas Mann and Norman Ornstein, who wrote a book detailing all this, saying Congress isn't broken. There's nothing wrong with, quote, Congress. What's wrong is the Republican Party have adopted this radical, radical nature in terms of the filibusters and absolutely refusing to allow anything to get done. Previously, Thomas Mann and Norman Ornstein were widely quoted in the press, often on television, and Media Matters last year took a look at how few times they're invited on the mainstream press to talk about their book, because you're really not supposed to talk about that. It's not, you know, accepted conversation to talk about how radical the Republican Party has come. Now, to their credit, CNN Today and on Howard Kurtz's reliable sources had Mann and Ornstein on, and they talked about this phenomena, and they talked about a little bit of how the press, you know, has really fallen down in terms of not telling people what's going on in Washington. Why isn't Congress functioning? It's not a problem of, quote, Congress. You know, there's a party that's willing to do things the way they've always done, which is the Democrats. Obama has been willing to compromise. He wanted a $250,000 tax, originally taxes above anyone who made $250,000. He ended up at nearly $500,000. That's called a compromise. This is traditionally how the thing how things work. News organizations ought to be talking about it. They ought to be talking about it internally, and they ought to soon have the guts to just be honest and be factually accurate in terms of talking about the methods the Republican Party has adopted in the House does not represent or does not match anything we have seen in American history in the past. That there shouldn't be anything controversial about that.
Well, Eric Bollett, you mentioned the compromise on the $450,000 for households. Prior to that, of course, the Republicans, particularly the Tea Party caucus, basically humiliated their speaker Boehner, right, by rejecting the one they wanted to protect the millionaires and billionaires and go up to $1 million. By the way, the ground had already been laid by both Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer on the Senate side. Both Democrats had also earlier suggested that they'd be happy with the $1 million threshold. So it's pretty clear that the Republicans are in the bag for the oligarchs, and particularly the Tea Party caucus will go to the mat to protect the interests of millionaires and billionaires. But it also seems pretty pervasive throughout Washington that that's what it's about. I'm not sure that there's much of a constituency left for people who actually care about the average American.
Well, both parties fought over that perception, that mantle, that title. Republican Party, a little less traditionally, would be seen as, you know, the party of big business, or business owners, Chamber of Commerce, and things like that. But you would think the Tea Party populism it was supposed to be this populism. You'd think they would have embraced that. They would have embraced a new form of conservative populism that embraced the working class, et cetera. But absolutely nothing like that has transpired. We're seeing more and more about how the Tea Party Freedom Works, for instance, was nothing more than this sort of puppet organization set up to, do the bidding of not just big business, but sort of super big business and things like that. There doesn't seem, if you look at this, if you were looking at this, you know, tax debate from the outside, you would wonder, okay, which party is actually interested in people making $70,000 or $80,000? But I think that is partly because the Republican Party has moved so radically far to the right in terms of their interests, in terms of super big business and things like that. And again, you don't see that reflection in the everyday media coverage in Washington. There's just, it's just he said, she said. And that's okay, but one of the he said she said is like on the edge of a cliff. You know, you would think that part would be included in the description.
Well, Eric Mollett, what about journalism schools? And, you know, I understand that this has been a convention for the longest time, this equal and opposite argument. And the, you know, the reductio absurdum of that is if you, you know, you have a Holocaust survivor on, you have to therefore interview a Holocaust denier. And this has been going on for some time. It was its actual origins are in the fact that newspaper owners basically didn't want to offend any of their readers. So they figured if you have, you know, do a story and just have the Republican version of reality than the Democratic version of reality, that way, you know, you're not going to lose half of your readers.
Yeah, you know, and frankly, it worked for several decades. And because both parties were sort of in the realm of the mainstream, one was on the right, one was on the left. A lot of the action took place in the middle. And I think for a couple decades you could effectively do that. Quote a Democrat, quote a Republican, quote a conservative, quote a liberal, and this is what people are talking about. But and when you've got, you know, the House Republicans, you know, so far over to the radical right, that framework doesn't work anymore. Because if you're quoting a Boehner or a Cantor or an aide that's so far over to the right, and then you're quoting a Hassert or one of his aides, that equation doesn't work anymore. Instead of looking like a simple triangle, you've got one from each side that are both basically the same distance apart from the middle. It doesn't work anymore, and that's what they're struggling with. How do we accurately portray where the conservative movement has gone, particularly under Obama, without being yelled at by conservatives, without being called liberal media, how do we still do our jobs? You know, it takes a certain amount of courage, mm-hmm. and it takes a certain amount of guts. And the right wing, thanks to Fox News and other places, has a very vicious attack machine, and it's no fun to be the target of that, and journalists do not want their names on Fox News as being called out as liberal and biased and unfair and things like that. So unfortunately, the easiest way to sort of keep your head down and pretend, and they are pretending because they know what's really going on. They know we've never really seen anything like this. The easiest thing is just to sort of keep pretending that this is normal when it's the opposite.
And of course, this has led to the Beltway reporting being essentially all about process, and that the reporters they get to talk a lot on cable TV are the ones that show that they have a lot of savvy about inside baseball, but they're incapable of making judgments, or at least they are afraid of making judgments. I thank you so much for joining us, Eric Mollett.
Oh, sure. Anytime. Talk to you soon.
Thank you. Again, I've been speaking with Eric Mollett, who's a senior fellow at Media Matters for America and a former senior writer for Salon. His books include Lapdogs, How the Press Rolled Over for Bush, and Bloggers on the Bus, How the Internet Changed Politics and the Press. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about Bashar al-Assad's speech to the Syrian people and its strange, surreal defiance and delusion. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Henri Barkey, who's a professor of international relations at Lehigh University. He served as a member of the United States Department of State's policy planning staff, working primarily on the Middle East, the Eastern Mediterranean, and intelligence from 1998 to 2000. He has authored and co-authored and edited 5 books, among them Turkey's Kurdish Question with Graham Fuller, Reluctant Neighbor, Turkey's Role in the Middle East, and most recently, European Response to Globalization's Resistance, Adaptation, and Alternatives. He has an article at the American Interest spinoff, The Syrian Crisis and the Future of Iraq. Welcome to Background Briefing, Henri Barkey.
Thank you.
And the President Bashar al-Assad addressed the Syrian people today from the Opera House in Damascus, and it was a speech full of defiance and delusion, but entirely devoid of any mention of a diplomatic possibility to end this war that's destroying Syria and has already claimed 60,000 lives. So are we therefore to expect more agony?
Well, yes. I mean, I think we shouldn't have expected anything else from Bashar al-Assad. I mean, essentially his regime is at stake. Whatever solution one ends up with in Syria will not include him, and he knows that. So he is going to try to survive and last until the very last moment. And he may very well end up dying in Syria, the way things are going at the moment. But he clearly doesn't understand how bad the situation is for him. It's getting worse by the day. It may still take months, maybe even a year, for him to finally lose power. But yes, you're right. There's going to be a lot more misery in Syria.
And I don't know whether you saw the video recently that was posted of the Shabiha, the pro-Assad militia, having captured some hapless prisoners. And they put 2 of them up against a wall and slowly slash them with knives all the time, yelling, calling, exalting their great leader, the Lord Bashar. And then they, after slashing them, they start stabbing them in a very, I mean, it's impossible to, I'm still in shock having made the mistake of watching it. The notion that the Alawites could see the Sunni, their brother, their fellow Syrians, as nothing more than animals to be slaughtered. It's so disturbing and so hard to get your head around.
Well, we have to be careful. I mean, I started watching the video, but then I turned it off because I think it was very, very disturbing, and I'm very glad that I did not watch it. That said, there's an important point that has to be made here, and that is that not all Alawites are Shabiha. Not Alawites are killers. Not all Alawites are such depraved individuals as the ones that you saw on that video. So I think we have to be careful, and for the sake of Syria, and for the sake of, you know, for human beings in Syria, that in the end, whatever emerges out of this will not be a situation where the majority of the population then goes on and slaughters the minority. I mean, they're all Syrians in the end. Yes, this regime has cynically made use of the minority to suppress the majority, and unfortunately, members of this minority will have to pay a huge price. But it should not be one of vengeance and violence. There are serious efforts being made, by the way, if you look at even at today's press reports, of lists being made of only the top government officials who are responsible for the violence and who will be charged in the aftermath of the regime's fall, so that not everybody gets accused. And I think this is an effort that has to be supported by the outside powers, by everybody, and otherwise it will be very, very grim. And I think it's not in the interest of anybody to see revenge violence in the aftermath of the fall of the regime.
And is this idea of using a minority to dominate the majority, doesn't that come out of colonialism? The British and the French, that's an old trick of theirs to empower a minority tribe and to bring them along and therefore control the country through the minority rather as opposed to empowering the majority.
Yes, but look, the Ottomans did it also in Iraq. I mean, Iraq was, when it was ruled by the Ottomans, was ruled by the Sunnis, and the British essentially inherited that system and maintained it in Iraq. So it's, yes, colonialism does this, and colonialism, when you don't have the manpower to control large territories, you will look for allies, and it's always easier to find allies in a minority. And therefore, all colonial regimes will do that. And it is not specific, I think, to France or Britain or any other colonial power. I mean, I think all powers that dominate in the end try to find these kinds of linkages. And in Iraq, we did see a minority also that maintained power for a very, very long time. And the Sunnis in Iraq, until the fall of Saddam Hussein, were 20% of the population and control the whole country. And yes, it's a remnant of the colonial, but it's also a remnant of history. So
sure.
We will continue. I mean, this is not unique to Syria.
Sure. Again, I'm speaking with Henri Bach. He's a professor of international relations at Lehigh University. He's also served as a member of the United States State Department's policy planning staff, working primarily on the Middle East, the Eastern Mediterranean, and intelligence from 1998 to 2000. And he has an article at the American Interest spinoff, The Syrian Crisis and the Future of Iraq. Since we've been talking about Iraq, Henri, let's turn to your article at the American Interest. And it's obviously a year since the U.S. pulled out of Iraq, and certainly the last thing one wants to reinforce is the Republican notion, John McCain and others saying that we have to stay in there. The fact that it's starting to really look like it's going to fall apart. It's not to suggest that the U.S. should have stayed any longer than they were did, and they clearly were unwelcome. And the Iraqis called it Iraq Day, the day that the U.S. left on the 31st of December 2011. So how much is this, do you think, this unrest in Anbar and amongst the Sunnis and the heavy-handed way that al-Maliki said he's going to crack down on it? Could this be the beginning of an unraveling?
It doesn't have to be, but it could be. There's no question that events in Syria are giving a lot of courage and encouragement, I should say, to the Sunnis in Iraq, who now see essentially another Shia offshoot regime about to fall in Damascus, and therefore they think that the Shia in Iraq will find themselves on the defensive, and this is a moment to push. And you see essentially the elements of miscalculations on both sides of the equation. That is to say, the Sunnis think that because in Syria the Bashar Assad regime is in trouble and it will be replaced by a Sunni majority government, that therefore they will get support from that new government and will be able to push their own agenda in Iraq. And the Sunnis in Iraq have yet to accept the fact that they are actually a minority in Iraq. Now, on the other hand, Maliki is also making a huge number of mistakes by being heavy-handed, as you said, by picking fights with everybody. And in the process, he's essentially deepening the divisions in Iraq, not just between Sunnis and Shia, but also between Kurds and the rest of Iraq, especially the Shia. And he's even creating, actually, interestingly, some divisions within his own Shia community. We saw this week Muqtada al-Sadr, the maverick Shia leader, who essentially went out of his way to criticize Maliki and support the Sunni opposition to Maliki. So it's very difficult to understand what is Maliki's strategy here, because the longer this chaos continues, and we've seen an uptick in violence, it's not as much as it was in the bad old days, but there is certainly an uptick in violence. Don't the week goes by when a bomb explodes in a few different places in Iraq, causing casualties? The although Iraq has a bright future because it sits on huge amounts of oil, it doesn't seem like the state is working. And the more it fails in delivering services to its citizens, whether it is energy, whether it is water, whether it is basic services from the bureaucracy, you will find that people are going to try to go their own way. And that's a big danger in Iraq. And there's no question that the Syrian crisis has also undermined essentially the border between Syria and Iraq. There is really no border between those two countries anymore. I mean, people are crossing. You have violent groups from moving from Syria to Iraq, from Iraq to Syria. So you're seeing essentially the erosion of the state system, if you want, in that part of the world. I mean, the famous Sykes-Picot Agreement of 1916 that drew the boundaries, the colonial boundaries of Iraq and Syria, which were artificial, admittedly, are now being questioned seriously. So, yes, the continuation of this and will, and or could, I should say, lead to a dismemberment of Iraq. And maybe that's why it should be. Who knows? But maybe something much better will emerge out of this. But it is not going to be bloodless. That's the unfortunate part of it.
And Henri Barki, clearly, if there was a winner of the Cheney-Bush Iraq war, it would have been, I think, the Iranians. And there's no question that al-Maliki is close to the Iranians, and the U.S. has essentially begged him not to allow Iran to overfly Iraq to supply the beleaguered Assad regime in Syria, at which the U.S. has failed to influence him in any way. So the Iranians are doubling down on their support for the Assads, and it would seem to me Iraq is as well. So what we're talking about, does al-Maliki recognize this possibility as much as the Iranians appear to?
Well, but I think to call the Iranians the ultimate victors, I think, would be wrong. I mean, yes, initially, after the Iraq invasion by the United States, the Iranians essentially did emerge as the winners in this geopolitical game. But it was temporary. I mean, the thing about the Middle East and the rest of the world is that it's very hard to predict the future, as Yogi Berra once said. I mean, where the Iranians were on the upswing, if you want, after the American invasion, now they're on the defensive. Losing Syria is far, far, far more important to them than making the gains that they will be making in Iraq. Because, first of all, Iraq, in some ways, because it's a majority Shia country, is more likely to chart its own course than the Syrians, which had a minority government that really relied on outside help. Now, losing Syria strategically is far more important to the Iranians. The Iranians are the losing one at the moment because their connection to the Lebanese Hezbollah movement, which they have funded and have supported and in many ways made it into a fighting force, relies heavily on the Syrians because that's the strategic depth, if you want, of the Hezbollah movement is Syria. The moment the Syrian regime collapses, Hezbollah is going to pay a price. And Hezbollah is going to be on the defensive in Lebanon and will lose out in the long run. So effectively, the Syrian uprising means that Iran is losing both Lebanon and Syria. And so the gains that it will be making essentially in Iraq are also not that significant because, as I said, Iraq is still, if it stays together, it's still a far more a country that can rely on itself because it has oil, because it has a large population, because it has essentially a more coherent history, if you want. And it's not going to be that easy for the Iranians to dominate Iraq. Yes, they will use Iraq as a strategic threat, but imagine, I mean, where the most advanced outpost was on the Mediterranean, now it's going to be in Baghdad. At the best. So the Iranians actually are coming out as the big losers of this Arab Spring, if you want. And yes, they thought at the beginning when Mubarak and the Tunisian leader fell that this was going to be their heyday, but it's turning out to be their worst nightmare. And don't be surprised if the Iranians start thinking of a way to negotiate with the United States on the nuclear issue because between these geopolitical changes and the sanctions, the Iranians are in terrible, terrible shape. They may not do it immediately. They may wait for the Iranian elections, presidential elections in the summer, and maybe after that you will see maybe a change in Iran, because I think the Iranians are in a very difficult position, like one they have never been in a long time.
So, well, Henri Barkey, is this a zero-sum situation in as much as Iran appears to be losing now? Does that mean that Saudi Arabia and the Gulf are winning?
That's a very good question. Yes, in some ways, especially the way they look at it. I mean, in the article I said that the two sides are essentially in a Manichaean struggle, if you want, and they would perceive any loss by Iran as a gain for themselves. But look, the Arab Spring has taught us one thing, that no one is immune from pressures from below. You know, when you think about Assad, at the beginning of the Arab Spring, Assad got up and gave an interview to the Wall Street Journal where he was so arrogant. He said, "Not these things happen in countries where the regime is not responsive to the demands of the people. But here in Syria, we are, you know, we do exactly what the people want. We are in tune." And he said he gave this interview in February, and in March the revolt started. So Saudi Arabia and the Gulf countries may sit pretty on a lot of money, but there is a lot of uncertainty. That doesn't mean that the regimes will collapse, but there's going to be pressure on the regimes, especially after the Assad regime falls, because people are seeing that, you know, they can overthrow regimes, they can put pressure, they can engage or force regimes to make reforms. And the Saudi government will also be faced with unpleasant situations whereby it will have to repress. It already is doing that in the Shia parts of Saudi Arabia, in the northeastern parts of the country. So we already saw in Bahrain the situation is quite dangerous, where the Shia majority is rebelling against the Sunni minority regime. That's another minority-majority crisis that has essentially now been put on the back burner because the Saudis have sent their own troops into Bahrain, and it's a small fish, it's a small place, etc. But it shows you that even in the Gulf countries, there are signs of unhappiness and there are signs of unrest. So, yes, in the short run, the Saudis will emerge victorious and will be very happy to see Assad go, and therefore the Iranians getting a black eye. But, you know, history continues. History doesn't stop with one event. And there will be other things that will affect the Saudis in different other ways.
Well, just in closing, it would seem, Henri Barkey, that if you compare Assad's phony democracy that he may have thought that he could sell to an interviewer, that he's responds to the will of the people, at least he had some semblance of a parliament. Saudi Arabia is an absolute monarchy. They are back in the Middle Ages.
Yeah, but look, I wouldn't. Especially when you look at pictures today of after Bashar's speech. I mean, parliament in Syria was not a parliament. The fact that they had a parliament doesn't mean it was a parliament. I mean, just take 100 people off the street and put them in a building and tell them to raise their hands when you know the applause sign goes up is not necessarily a parliament. To me, there was really not that much difference between the Saudi and the Syrian regimes. In fact, one can make the argument that the Saudi control over its population is in some ways more subtle. I mean, they use religion, they use different forms of legitimacy, they use certain types of shura councils, etc. I'm not saying that this. What I'm just saying to say is that there was not much difference between Assad Syria and the Saudi regime. In fact, the Assad regime used far more violence to maintain power than the Saudis do. So it should.
Right, but at the end of the day, I think
those kinds of comparisons are kind of dangerous sometimes.
Right, and not particularly useful. But there is a distinct difference. Assad is a fairly secular regime, and the Saudis. Even though the royal family live in luxury and have all that oil money sloshing around, they do have a tiger by the tail with the theocracy that they created.
Look, fair enough. But secularism in of itself is not a virtue if it comes with brute violence.
Sure.
So what difference does it make whether you're being repressed by a theocratic regime or by a secular regime? At the end of the day, you're being repressed, and the outcome is the same. And my argument was that the secular regime in Syria is probably worse than the Saudi regime because it used much more violence.
Right.
That is not to say that the Saudi regime is necessarily that much better off, but let's face it, I mean, it does not use the kind of violence that the Syrians have used.
Sure. At this point, at least.
Right.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us, Henri Barkey. Very interesting discussion. I enjoyed it.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Henri Barkey. He's a professor of international relations at Lehigh University. He served as a member of the United States State Department's policy planning staff, working primarily on the Middle East, the Eastern Mediterranean, and intelligence from 1998 to 2000. He's authored, co-authored, and edited 5 books, among them Turkey's Kurdish Question with Graham Fuller, and Reluctant Neighbor, Turkey's Role in the Middle East, and most recently, European Response to Globalization, Resistance, Application, and Alternatives. He has an article at the American Interest spinoff, The Syrian Crisis and the Future of Iraq. We're going to take a brief station break, and we're back talking about the jobs report and how America's economy is basically an economy which is about profits, not prosperity.
It's all about strikes now, so it would strike in me.
They offered me the office, offered me the job. They said I better take anything they got. Do you want to make tea at the BBC? Do you want to be? Do you really want to be a cop? Opportunities are one and never not. Every job they offer used to keep you at the dock. Now we are opportunities.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is William Lozonik, who's a professor of economics and director of the University of Massachusetts Center for Industrial Competitiveness. He is president of the Academic Industry Research Network, and his book, Sustainable Prosperity in the New Economy, Business Organization and High-Tech Employment in the United States, won the 2010 Schumpeter Prize. He has an article at the Huffington Post, Robots Don't Destroy Jobs, Rapacious Corporate Executives Do. Welcome to Background Briefing, William Lozonik.
Hi, it's good to talk to you again.
And Bill, the Labor Department came out with a report on its jobs report on Friday, saying that the U.S. economy has added 155,000 jobs in December, but that unemployment rate is holding at 7.8%. In your article at the Huffington Post, Robots Don't Destroy Jobs, Rapacious Corporate Executives Do, you make the point that Americans' economy is really about profits without prosperity. Elaborate, if you will.
Okay. I think in general, if companies are making profits, you have a potential for growing jobs, for a growing economy. That's good. And in fact, historically, certainly, I would say up until the 1980s in the United States, post-World War II, when you had profits, the vast majority of workers in the economy gained. And it's pretty simple because companies were reinvesting those profits. They were reinvesting them in plant and equipment and in training people to operate the plant and equipment. And they were giving those people pretty secure employment. You really had a norm at that time in most major corporations of, if you did your job well, you had a career with the company and you didn't have mass layoffs. And all that started to change in the 1980s. And I would say that, we go through cycles and we have things like the Great Recession of a couple years ago, which in some ways is still with us, but there's a long-run problem of creating not only jobs, but good jobs in the United States. So even when you have a situation like you have now, where the some jobs are being created. It's sluggish. Even the jobs that are being created are really not that great. And I would say that it's mainly because corporations, which are very profitable at this point, are just not reinvesting in the U.S. economy in terms of jobs, in terms of innovation, in terms of the kinds of capabilities that you need to have, particularly in a rich economy, to compete globally.
Well, it would seem to me that this last deal that came through, the fiscal cliff deal, that a lot of the press and the politicians are heralding as a good deal, in many ways, it doesn't look to me like it's solving the underlying problem of the unfairness in American society. It's true that the wealthy do pay more taxes, back to the Clinton era of 39.6%, but then the Bush tax cuts are still there for people, households under $450,000. But more importantly, the capital gains tax did not go back up to the 39.6. It's only up 5% from 15% to 20, and that's how the wealthy basically make their money and avoid their taxes. So, and if you combine that with corporate America sitting on all this cash, which they hide abroad or hide in the Cayman Islands, and how executives and CEOs buy back stock in order to improve their positions and make themselves more wealthy, but instead of investing in these corporate funds in R&D and new products and new factories and hiring workers, isn't that the real picture that we've got here in America?
Yeah. So I think that in many ways, the unwillingness of the corporate elite to pay what you might call their fair share of taxes, to actually support a progressive tax structure, reflects what's going on from their positions within corporations. I think when corporate executives, and you know, don't want to over glorify the good old days, but I think there was a time when corporate executives saw keeping their people employed, expanding employment, expanding the kinds of products and processes they're producing. They tended to recognize that you had to have government support to invest in infrastructure. You had to have government for support for education. You had to have a whole bunch of things that their corporations, not just them individually, but the corporations as a whole, really required to do business. And I think since now, they have been really much more focused on really, in a sense, taking money out of those corporations rather than putting money into them for their own gain. You know, it follows that they want to get as low tax rate as possible. They really just do not have any broader interests in mind other than their own interests. And, of course, one of the things that I have been writing about for a long time, which you mentioned, is, okay, they're making lots of profits. What are they doing with it? A lot of what they're doing with their profits is buying back stock for the S&P 500 or the top 500 companies, about 75% of the market capitalization of the U.S. Stock markets. Over the last decade, probably around 55% of their profits were spent just buying back their own company stock, which is basically just trying to manipulate the stock price. I argue the main reason they do this is because in a context where corporations are become evaluated and top executives have been willing to allow themselves to be evaluated by their stock price, the corporate executives themselves make out very well in terms of their pay, mainly because the biggest components of their pay have to do with stock-based compensation, particularly stock options.
So in other words, the financialization of the U.S. economy continues, and this these buyback options game goes on in corporate America. And meanwhile, where are the jobs going to come from in the future?
Well, okay. So, I think it's something like 83% of jobs come from the corporate sector, another 11% from the government sector, and then the rest is self-employment. So if businesses don't invest and create jobs, then we have a big problem. Now, one of the things in the article you mentioned that I criticize, and it was reflected in an article written earlier in the month by Paul Krugman in the New York Times called Robots and Robber Barons, where he really accepted the argument that automation displaces jobs, and on first sight it sounds like that makes sense. In fact, it's not the case. That's something that has been used really an excuse for not looking at what the real problems are. When companies invest in automation, as I argue in my article, there's all kinds of other employment that is created, even if certain jobs are lost or certain parts of certain jobs are lost, because obviously automation does automate away certain tasks, and those jobs can be created in actually producing the robots, producing the machines that are part of the automation process. Their jobs are created because companies that invest in automation have to make good on that investment. They have to get more supplies. They have to manage the process. They have to expand to cover the cost of this to get global markets. So they build up organizations that employ lots of people doing lots of things. And in fact, this is a platform for them moving into new types of services, new types of products that they wouldn't have been able to do without automation. The other thing is that a lot of the automation that's going on now is for jobs that nobody could have ever done. And so it's if you really, particularly in aero and nanotechnology, you make investments in new technology, you're creating things that products and processes that the economy wasn't capable of even thinking of producing before. And so you have to have investment in new technology. You have to have investment in all the capabilities of people that both implement and develop and utilize those technologies. And if you do that, you're going to be much better off. So that's not the problem. The problem is, in fact, we don't have enough of that type of investment in the United States. And as I said, the other side of this, there's plenty of profits to make that investment, so that's not the problem. The problem is the way those resources are being allocated by corporate executives and the incentives that they have to allocate them in ways that just give short-term boosts to stock price, benefit themselves, but don't benefit the economy as a whole.
Again, I'm speaking with William Lozonik, who's a professor of economics and director of the University of Massachusetts' the Center for Industrial Competitiveness. He's the president of the Academic Industry Research Network and the author of Sustainable Prosperity in the New Economy, Business Organization and High-Tech Employment in the United States, which won the 2010 Schumpeter Prize. He also has an article at the Huffington Post, Robots Don't Destroy Jobs, Rapacious Corporate Executives Do. So it would seem to me that, William Lozonik, that, you know, we have definitely drifting towards a plutonomy and a rule by an oligarchy who aren't necessarily invested in the United States. They're a part of a kind of global elite, and I'm not sure that they care particularly about the American people, and the fact that so much of their money is sitting in these places like the Cayman Islands says a lot. And obviously the notion of their excuse has always been this new global competitive environment that we have because of globalism, which essentially become an excuse for the fact that they're just cutting loose their fellow Americans and throwing them away as though they were disposable. What can be done to create a new kind of economic patriotism?
Well, yeah. So it's an interesting question because, we saw this in the Mitt Romney campaign, you know, someone who running for president, who I would say probably is as patriotic as anyone else, but who actually made his fortune largely, not entirely, but largely by taking over companies, laying people off, and stripping out as much money as possible for Bain Capital and its principles, and including himself. Now, so the problem in many ways is that the people who say they know what to do for the U.S. economy, top executives, and often are and probably might be very genuinely patriotic, have this view, which is very self-serving at the same time, that what their companies do has nothing to do with how the economy performs in terms of job creation, in terms of investment. And I don't talk about this in terms of fairness. I talk about this in terms of competitiveness. If those companies are not investing in the labor force, if they're not investing in new products and processes, if they're not investing in innovation, then the United States over the long term cannot be competitive. And what they actually are doing are they're living off the gains of past success in many cases rather than investing for the future. So it's not, I mean, what makes it even worse in a sense is that those are the people who not just the Republicans turn to, but the Democrats turn to say, well, what can we do about the economy? You know, you just look at the case of the Jobs Council that President Obama created, I guess, about 2 years ago around this time, totally stacked with, I think, of 26 people. 24 were corporate types, most of them top executives, and chaired by Jeffrey Immelt, who would have claimed that he's as patriotic as anybody else, and maybe he is, but from his point of view, the company that he heads, General Electric, if it, as it does, buys back $10 billion of its stock in a year to boost its stock price, that's just fine. That's the way you do business, and that can't be the way you do business. That money should be used to support the government investment in the next round of new technologies. It should be supporting keeping experienced people at places like General Electric employed, finding ways in which their human capital can be preserved and be made useful, and investing much more deeply than they do in the technologies of the future. Those same corporate executives, while they're doing this as corporate executives, actually are constantly turning to the government and saying, we want you to subsidize our companies even more by investing in these new technologies. So they would like that investment to be made, but they aren't willing, as they have to, if it's going to get done, to shoulder a big part of that investment themselves. They want to foist it all on the taxpayers. And then when it comes time to, when they're making profits and you think, okay, the taxpayers can get a return here, they say, no, we need even lower tax rates if we're going to make these investments.
Well, William Lozonik, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Okay, thanks.
Again, I've been speaking with William Lozonik, who's a professor of economics and director of the University of Massachusetts Center for Industrial Competitiveness. He is the president of the Academic Industry Research Network, and his book, Sustainable Prosperity in the New Economy, Business Organization and High-Tech Employment in the United States, won the 2010 Schumpeter Prize. He has an article at the Huffington Post, Robots Don't Destroy Jobs, Rapacious Corporate Executives Do. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And the conversation continues at facebook.com/ianmastersmedia. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. An angel sung about the home of the brave and this land you run the free. One time, one time.